16-year-old Ralph Jarl was shot in the head and the arm when he went to pick up his younger twin brothers on April 13th. He mistakenly went to 115th Street instead of 115th Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri. 2 days later, April 15th, 20-year-old Kalen Gillis was shot and killed after pulling into the wrong driveway in rural upstate New York. On that same day in South Florida, an 18 and 19-year-old were shot at after trying to deliver groceries and pulling into the driveway next door to their destination. Last Monday, two high school cheerleaders were shot after one of the girls accidentally tried to get into the wrong car outside of Austin, Texas. And last Tuesday, a man in North Carolina shot at a 6-year-old and other family members after a basketball rolled into his yard and neighbors came to retrieve it. Charges have been filed in most of those incidents. The string of shootings of apparently non-threatening people has raised questions about U.S. and state laws on self-defense, as well as things like stand your ground and castle doctrine laws. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the string of shootings you may have seen in the news? Do you have questions about what does and doesn't constitute self-defense under federal or state law? Where do you think that line should be drawn? Do you worry about your kid's safety, say, if they get lost or show up at the wrong place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the UW Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. My pleasure to be here.
Now, it's kind of tricky to talk about all these different incidents. They'll have their own way through court as allegations are dealt with. But big picture, John, it seems like these cases, as they're being described in the media, go beyond what we would consider, what the law would consider self-defense. Do I have that right?
Yes. These cases go way beyond what the law would traditionally recognize as self-defense. And I think all of them have kind of one thing in common, which is that there really is no perceived threat, certainly no imminent threat to the people who are resorting to deadly force.
Right. The notion that, okay, somebody is on my front lawn or at my front door or pulling up my driveway, triggering, sorry to use the word, but leading to me shooting at them, that under any law, I think in any state, that alone wouldn't constitute an argument of self-defense?
That's correct. You're really never allowed to use deadly force to protect property. And in all of these cases, the best argument that someone has is that the person was somehow trespassing on their property. And that's not treated the same as, you know, a physical threat of violence. And so you really don't have the right to use deadly force unless you reasonably believe someone is about to use deadly force against you.
Let's talk about some of the self-defense laws around the country. Let's start here in Wisconsin. What we hear phrases like stand your ground and castle doctrine and duty to retreat. What is in place here in Wisconsin?
So Wisconsin does not have a stand your ground law, and Wisconsin does not also have an explicit duty to retreat. And just so people understand, right, the law of self-defense grew up around this idea that if you could retreat from a situation, then you were not entitled to use deadly force. If you could avoid using deadly force and still safely remove yourself from a situation where you felt threatened, you should do that. The one exception to that traditionally has been what the law called the castle doctrine, which refers to your home being your castle. And it says that if you are in your home or you come into your home and you see an intruder there or someone is attempting to break into your home, you don't have to leave the home. You can stay in your home and use deadly force. And the touchstone in Wisconsin for use of force is the reasonableness of the force in relationship to the threat that you perceive. And also, when we talk about deadly force, the law says that you can use deadly force to prevent great bodily harm or death to yourself, but it has to be to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. And that's the word that the statute that uses, imminent. So it can't be I might be under threat. It has to be a reasonable belief that you are in imminent danger of death or serious bodily harm.
I know with when it comes to the police use of force, there are Supreme Court set standards on that sort of reasonable perception. And some of that can feel a little subjective. In what instance could that officer in that instance feel that there was a legitimate threat here? How much does self-perception of a threat? Well, it may not have looked like it to an outside observer, but I felt threatened as a person claiming self-defense.
So the standard really relies on that the reasonableness of that subjective belief. And we can imagine situations where people might have a reasonable belief that someone is about to harm them, maybe even seriously harm them, even if they haven't yet seen the person brandishing a weapon. So an example I like to give about this, if someone has previously threatened you, they've threatened to kill you, they show up outside of your place of employment and reach into their pocket as if they were going to draw out a gun and shoot you, at that point, you might be reasonable for you to think, I need to use deadly force to defend myself. So it's a very case-by-case specific analysis, but you know, again, a touchstone really here is that it has to be a reasonable belief, and the perceived threat does have to be imminent.
Talking to John Gross with the UW Law School, looking at self-defense, the laws around the country where they do and don't apply. After a series that I listed earlier of events over the last couple weeks, people shot for accidentally showing up on a different doorstep than they'd meant to, or in a different driveway than they'd meant to. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, you mentioned the Castle Doctrine, which is in effect in Wisconsin. One that isn't, and I threw out the phrase here, Stand Your Ground Laws of Florida, passed, I believe, the first one in the country in 2005. What does that mean?
So stand your ground laws typically refer to a statute that changes the law regarding self-defense in that it removes a duty to retreat when you are in a public space. So again, the traditional law was, we don't want you to resort to deadly force if you can safely withdraw from a situation and not use deadly force. The one exception is when we're talking about your home. The stand your ground laws essentially say, if you are somewhere where you are legally entitled to be, you can use deadly force and there is no obligation for you to retreat, even if you could safely retreat. And so I think a legitimate criticism of these laws is that it really authorizes people to use deadly force in a situation where it's simply not necessary that they do so. And that has led, I think, to some very high profile cases of people resorting to deadly force when there's a legitimate question about whether or not they just could have shown the person they had a gun and walked away from the situation. And so stand your ground. The essence of the stand your ground law is those states that adopt them are removing any duty to retreat, even if it's safe for you to do so.
John, I've spent enough time in bars to see angry disputes that you could envision escalating outside the bar to a point where each side, each participant feels that they are under threat, and each participant could claim self-defense if they escalated the violence further under a stand your ground type law. Is that a concern?
It's very much a concern. I mean, I think the law naturally developed with this idea that you should try to retreat. And the law did that because the law says, in the eyes of the law, right, the preservation of human life is extremely important. And so we don't want to encourage people to resort to deadly violence unless they really feel like there's an imminent threat to their own safety. And so to some degree, these stand your ground laws kind of encourage people to reach for a gun when cooler heads should really prevail.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm so glad you're talking about this. I have weapons training, Madison West Girls Rifle Club in the 60s, and also I've been burglarized at least twice living in New York City. And the conflict I see between the castle theory and self-protection and everything is, if a burglar is entering your home when you're there, and you have the double goal of keeping your family safe, what are you going to do? Oh, excuse me, Mr. Burglar, if you can give me like 3 minutes, I'll go and find my key and unlock the drawer that my pistol is in so I can defend myself. You know, I have to keep it safe from the children. To my mind, you're much more in danger of having your own family injured with your own pistol than from a burglar.
Okay, thanks for the call, Kay, from some personal experience there. John raising a lot of the, ambivalence people might feel about having a gun in the home for self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, the statistics show that, people are far more likely to commit suicide with a gun than they are to commit a homicide with the gun. And so we do have an enormous problem in the country about self-harm with firearms. And so there really is, you know, a lot of questions as the caller raises about, does having the firearm in your home really make you safer overall?
Okay, thanks for the call. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director there of the Public Defender Project. Talking about the recent cases around the country of young people being shot after mistakenly entering someone's property without presenting an obvious threat. And looking at self-defense laws in Wisconsin and around the country, what they do and don't allow, you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. Looking at recent stories of young people being shot or shot at after pulling into the wrong driveway, ringing the wrong doorbell, or opening the wrong car door. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions to that string of stories, your questions or thoughts on the current state of self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country. We'll go back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Spring Green. Michael, hi.
Hi. I've got a question for your guest. To get a concealed carry weapon, you have to take a safety course. And in that course, there are a lot of issues that are brought up that help one really understand the power of a gun and the power of when and when not to use it. Do you think that requiring everyone, regardless of what kind of gun they buy, to have a course would be a good idea?
Even for people who don't get a concealed carry permit, Michael, I gotcha. John, what do you think?
I definitely think that's a good idea. I mean, I think that just speaks to, you're talking about, you know, people having lethal weapons. Semi-automatic handguns can fire, even in untrained hands, they can fire, multiple bullets in a second. We, of course, make people get licenses to drive motor vehicles because motor vehicles are potentially dangerous and can take a life. And so I think it would be reasonable to also say if anybody wants to exercise their right and purchase a gun or carry a gun, there should be some basic safety and training associated with that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Michael. Mark joins us now in De Pere. Mark, hi.
Hello, my name's Mark. I was once walking out of the along the shoreline where the water laps the sand on a county park just outside a county park along Lake Michigan, and one of the people in one of the houses walked out with a shotgun, saying that I was trespassing and threatened me. And so I obviously went back off their property. But am I actually trespassing when I'm walking at that place where the water meets the land?
Mark, thanks for the call. John, I believe people have access to that. That's a whole different class of law. But enforcing a perceived trespassing law with a shotgun, that does fit into our conversation, I think.
Yeah, it does. And as I mentioned earlier, you're not entitled to use deadly force to protect property. It's seen as unreasonable to do so because while property might be damaged or even destroyed, it can be replaced. Somebody's life cannot be replaced. And so trespasses on property, or even destruction of property. If somebody were to come into your driveway and, you know, hit your car, you know, with a hammer, you know, you're not allowed to shoot them. They're not directing a threat to your personal safety. And so the law says that's an unreasonable way of enforcing a property right to take someone's life.
Thanks for the call, Mark, and sharing that, that scary experience. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first question is, if the police come to your door and they don't have a warrant, and you open the door, which maybe you shouldn't, but you open the door to talk to them, and then they put their foot inside the house where you can't shut it, and that would make me frightened. What do you do in that sort of situation?
John, thanks for the call. I'm guessing this would not be a case where you would have a case for lethal force under self-defense, John.
No, you would not. And I think that there's an important distinction here about regarding law enforcement. And even if you perceive law enforcement to be violating one of your rights, if you think law enforcement has illegally entered your property, if you think they've illegally detained you, you can't use force against law enforcement officers. You have other remedies. You can file a civil lawsuit against them for a violation of your civil rights. But the law does not allow you to resist even what you might legitimately believe is an unlawful use of police force with force against those officers. That would be a crime.
Thanks for the call. Ryan joins us now in Amory. Ryan, hello.
Hi. I think that these laws are just dripping with racism. The practical effect is certainly that white people can stand their ground and black people can't. It is so unjust. I asked Philando Castile about stand your ground. He was an NRA member in St. Paul that told an officer he had a gun. The officer instinctively shot him and killed him.
Ryan, thanks for the call. John, have you looked at or thought about the racial implications of our self-defense laws?
There is absolutely the potential for not just explicit racial bias, but implicit racial bias, because the law talks about somebody's reasonable perceptions, right? And so if somebody, because of racism in society, if not a specifically held racist belief, but just an implicit bias toward people of color, perceiving them as more threatening. And if jurors feel that way as well, you have the potential to excuse the use of deadly force against people in society based on racism. And I have to say, too, there's a long history of firearms regulation specifically tailored to political groups, including the Black Panthers, who sought to arm themselves and saw a backlash against the use and access of firearms because they were suddenly in the hands of people of color. And that prompted a wave of regulation of firearms back in the 60s and 70s. Of course, since then, we've had a much more loosening of those regulations, which leads to the kind of proliferation of guns that we have in the country now.
Thanks for that call, Ryan. Dante is with us now in Green Bay. Dante, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, do stand your ground laws or self-defense, do they still count if you initiated a physical altercation? Let's say you were angry, you got in a fight. Now you're in a fight you can't win, and now you got to shoot your way out of it. Do those laws still apply?
Dante, thanks for the call. Yeah, can I claim self-defense if I started the physical altercation in the first place, John?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, in Wisconsin, like in many other states, one of the factors that goes into evaluating whether or not you had a right to use self-defense was whether or not you provoked the encounter. And the law basically is if you did provoke the other person, if you did something that was illegal, right, and was likely to provoke them to attack you or get in a physical confrontation with you, you can't claim self-defense. You can't claim use of deadly force unless you have exhausted every opportunity to retreat from that situation. So yes, provocation does impact whether or not the law is going to recognize your right to use deadly force.
Thanks for that call. John, in just our last minute here, again, I listed those five different incidents over the course of just 1 week this month. Are you concerned that people are looking at our self-defense laws, misperceiving them, misconstruing them, and reaching for that gun way sooner than the law would allow as a result?
I mean, these recent cases certainly make the case for that argument. I mean, I think people may not understand when they are entitled to use self-defense. They may be confusing the laws of different states. They may also just be a situation where people are increasingly marginalized and engaging in less social interaction. I mean, I can't help but be old enough to remember when sometimes you had to stop and ask someone for directions. Mm-hmm. Now we have GPS, and so pulling into the wrong driveway is perceived as a threat by some people. But yes, I mean, I think these incidents highlight that people should be hesitating to use deadly force, not embracing the idea they have the right to use it.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School and Director of the Public Defender Project. He joined us with a look at self-defense laws here in Wisconsin and around the country, following a number of recent stories of young people being shot when they mistakenly approached the wrong house or vehicle.